Have you ever walked into a room where everyone assumed you didn't belong? Ruth Ann Coleman walked into that government impound lot in March 1987, and not a single man there believed she had $6,000 to spend.
See, the flywheel here is
loose.
A loose flywheel? Seriously?
She's boring us with tractor talk again.
Fine, be that way.
Morning, and nobody bid. Not on the first tractor, not on the second, and certainly not on the rusted, seized, immovable hulk of a 1963 John Deere 4020. That sat at the back of the lot outside Abilene, Texas. Its engine locked solid, its tires flat to the rim, its serial number stamped into a frame the county had declared legally unsellable to any licensed farm equipment dealer in the state. The auctioneer moved on. That was his job. But Ruth Ann Coleman didn't move on. She stood at the edge of that lot in a worn Carhartt jacket that had been washed so many times the canvas had softened to the weight of cotton, and she counted the tractors the way a jeweler counts stones. Not for what they were, but for what they could become. 14 machines. 14 pieces of equipment the federal government had seized from bankrupt farms across West Texas between 1984 and 1987 during the worst agricultural collapse since the Dust Bowl. 14 tractors with fouled carburetors, locked axles, dead batteries, and paperwork problems that made every legitimate dealer walk away shaking their heads. Ruth raised her hand when the auctioneer reached the 4,020. The man didn't even look at her. He scanned the crowd of men in flannel shirts and feed caps waiting for a real bid. She raised her hand higher. Someone behind her laughed a short bark of amusement that carried across the lot like a gunshot. The auctioneer finally noticed his eyes narrowing with something between confusion and irritation. $400. That's what Ruth offered for a machine that hadn't turned over in 3 years, whose previous owner had run it without coolant for the better part of a summer. The auctioneer looked past her again, waiting. No other bids came. His gavel came down. Sold. She did it 13 more times. By noon, Ruth Ann Coleman had spent $5,800 of the $6,200 she had in savings and owned every seized tractor in that impound lot. She stood in the Texas sun writing down serial numbers in a small spiral-bound notebook while the men who'd come to bid packed up their trucks and drove away. One of them, a dealer from San Angelo, muttered as he passed her ladies buying herself a pile of scrap. Ruth didn't respond. She just kept writing. Her handwriting was small and precise, each number recorded with the care of someone who understood that details mattered, that the difference between a 3020 pump and a 4020 pump was the difference between a machine that ran and a machine that destroyed itself. But what nobody in that auction lot knew was that Ruth Ann Coleman had been rebuilding engines since she was 12 years old, the same month her father died, and left her mother with a failing farm and three broken tractors. She drove home with the notebook on the passenger seat beside her, the paper already showing dirt smudges from her hands. The March wind came through the truck's open window, carrying the smell of turned earth and diesel exhaust. Spring in West Texas. Planting season approaching. Every farmer within 200 miles scrambling to get equipment ready, and Ruth had just bought 14 machines that couldn't plant anything. Her father had taught her mechanics starting when she was 8 years old. James Carson, who'd farmed 800 acres of cotton outside Lubbock until the day his heart gave out in their shop on a July afternoon in 1948. He'd been holding a torque wrench when he died. Ruth found him there after school, his hand still gripping the tool his body slumped against a Farmall H tractor he'd been rebuilding. She was 12 years old. She didn't call for help right away. First, she finished the rebuild. It took her 4 hours working alone in the shop with her father's body cooling 10 feet away. She torqued the head bolts to specification, reconnected the fuel lines, checked the timing. When she finally went to get her mother, the tractor was ready to run. They sold it 2 weeks later to pay for the funeral. Her mother sold the farm 3 months after that and moved them to Abilene. Ruth never forgot the feeling of that afternoon, the weight of the wrench in her hand, the smell of oil and metal, the way solving a mechanical problem could create a space where grief couldn't reach you. For 4 hours, she hadn't been a 12-year-old girl who'd just lost her father. She'd been a mechanic finishing a job. At 14, she got work cleaning at Morrison's John Deere dealership in Abilene, sweeping floors, emptying trash, scrubbing grease off workbenches. She watched the mechanics while she worked memorizing how they diagnosed problems, how they read service manuals, how they talked to the machines, like the machines could talk back. At night, she practiced on abandoned equipment in a vacant lot behind her mother's apartment building. By 16, she could rebuild a carburetor faster than most of the dealership's mechanics. She didn't go to college. Her mother couldn't afford it, and the guidance counselor at her high school had made it clear that mechanical work wasn't a career path for young women. She got her GED at 22, married Frank Coleman at 24. Frank sold insurance steady work with a reliable income. They had a daughter, Jennifer, in 1964. Ruth kept cleaning at Morrison's, kept watching, kept learning. In 1965, when she was 29 years old, one of Morrison's mechanics quit without notice during harvest season. The shop was underwater with repair orders, and the owner, desperate, asked Ruth if she could help with basic maintenance work. Oil changes, filter replacements, nothing complicated. She said yes. By the end of the week, she was rebuilding a diesel injection pump that two of the dealership's regular mechanics had given up on. The owner offered her a full position. 22 years she worked there. 22 years turning wrenches, diagnosing problems, rebuilding engines that other mechanics had declared dead. She became a master mechanic, the only woman in West Texas with that certification. Farmers started requesting her specifically when they brought equipment in because Ruth had a reputation for fixing things that couldn't be fixed. She could diagnose a failing hydraulic pump from the sound it made 3 bays away. She could feel a misaligned bearing through the vibration in a wrench handle. She didn't need computerized diagnostic equipment because the machines told her what was wrong if you knew how to listen. December 1986. The new owner called her into his office. Young man, 34 years old, MBA from somewhere that wasn't Texas. He told her the dealership was modernizing. Computerized diagnostics were the future. They needed younger staff people who could work with the new systems. He said it like he was doing her a favor, like 50 years old was ancient, like 50 years old meant she couldn't learn. She found out later through a former colleague who still worked the floor that the real reason wasn't about computers. The new owner wanted a professional image. That meant an all-male shop. That meant mechanics who looked like what people expected mechanics to look like. That meant Ruth Ann Coleman needed to go. They gave her $3,200 in severance. 22 years of work reduced to a check that barely covered 2 months of mortgage payments. She cleaned out her toolbox on a Friday afternoon, loading wrenches and socket sets and specialized equipment she'd bought herself into the back of her truck. The younger mechanics watched her leave. None of them said anything. Frank didn't understand why she was taking it so hard. She had savings. They had his income. She could retire, maybe find part-time work doing something easier, something more appropriate for a woman her age. He said it kindly, meaning well, but the words landed like stones. Ruth was 51 years old, not dead. She had 39 years of knowledge. 39 years of skills that the world had just told her it didn't need anymore. She spent 2 months driving to every government impound lot within 200 miles of Abilene, writing down serial numbers of seized farm equipment. By late February, she had a list of 43 tractors. Most were in terrible condition. Many had paperwork problems that made them legally complicated to resell. All of them were cheap, because nobody wanted to take on machines with that many problems. The night before the March auction, she sat at the kitchen table with her notebook and a calculator, adding up what she could afford. Frank stood in the doorway, watching her work his face, showing the careful neutrality of a man who'd learned not to argue with his wife when her mind was set. He asked what she was planning. She told him she was going to buy tractors and rebuild them. He asked why. She looked up from her calculations, and for the first time since December, her eyes had something in them besides resignation. "Because I can." The evening after the auction, Ruth pulled into her driveway just as the sun was dropping below the horizon. Frank's car was already there, which meant he was home from work. She sat in the truck for a moment, hands still on the wheel, trying to figure out how to explain what she'd done. $5,800, most of their savings. Gone in 3 hours on machines that couldn't run. The kitchen smelled like coffee when she came through the door. Frank stood at the counter, his back to her, pouring from a pot he must have just made. He didn't turn around. "You went to the auction?" "Yes. Buy anything, all of it." Frank turned, then coffee pot still in his hand. His face showed no anger, just a kind of tired concern that was somehow worse. He set the pot down carefully like he was buying himself time to think of what to say next. How much? 5,800. The number hung in the air between them. Ruth could see him doing the math, calculating what that meant for their savings for the mortgage for Jenny's college expenses. Their daughter was still at Texas Tech 2 more years until graduation, and the tuition payments weren't getting smaller. Ruth, we have a mortgage. Jenny's still in school. I know. Nobody's going to rent a tractor from a woman working out of a shed. The words came out gentle, but they cut anyway. Not because Frank was being cruel, but because he was being practical. Because he was probably right. Because the world they lived in didn't make space for 51-year-old women who rebuilt tractors in their spare time and expected anyone to take them seriously. Maybe it's time to accept you're retired. Ruth looked at her husband. This man she'd been married to for 27 years, who sold insurance and played by the rules and believed that problems had solutions if you just found the right approach. She loved him. But in that moment, she also hated him a little bit for saying out loud the thing everyone else was thinking. I'm 51, not dead. Frank ran his hand through his hair, a gesture of frustration he usually tried to hide. They had bills. They had responsibilities. They had a life that depended on making sensible decisions, and spending $5,800 on broken tractors wasn't sensible. What's the plan here? Really? Ruth pulled out the notebook, opened it to the first page where she'd sketched out rough calculations. She walked him through it. Buy seized equipment at auction below market value because nobody else would bid on machines with obvious mechanical failures. Rebuild them to working order. Rent them by the season to farmers who needed operational capacity they couldn't afford to replace. The rental would cover the cost of the machine in 1 to 2 seasons. After that, profit. Frank listened. He was a good man, careful with money, but not mean about it. When she finished, he asked the question she'd been expecting. And when one breaks down in the middle of harvest. When a farmer's got 400 acres to bring in and your rebuilt tractor dies, I fix it. You can't be everywhere. I can be where I'm needed. They stood in the kitchen as darkness filled the windows and the coffee pot cooled on the counter. Finally, Frank picked up the pot and poured 2 cups, sliding one across to Ruth. It was the closest thing to acceptance she was going to get. Jenny came home for spring break that weekend, pulling into the driveway in her roommate's borrowed car. She was 23, finishing her accounting degree, planning to graduate in May, and moved to Dallas for a job she'd already lined up. She found Ruth in the garage going through toolboxes, sorting wrenches and socket sets into organized rows. Mom, what's all this? Getting ready. For what? Jenny listened as Ruth explained the auction, the tractors, the plan. Unlike Frank, she didn't question the math or the logistics. She asked different questions. Where would Ruth work? What about parts suppliers? How would she handle customers who didn't want to work with a woman? Ruth answered each one. She'd already rented a metal building on the edge of their property for $180 a month. For parts, she'd found a retired dealer in Amarillo who still had a warehouse full of 1960s John Deere inventory that nobody had wanted for a decade. For customers who didn't want to work with a woman, well, those weren't her customers. Jenny sat on an overturned bucket watching her mother work. After a while, she mentioned that she'd been struggling with her accounting courses. The theory made sense, but the practical application felt disconnected from anything real. She was thinking about maybe dropping the major, switching to something else. Ruth stopped sorting wrenches and looked at her daughter. You finish what you start. I taught you that. The words came out harder than she'd intended, sharpened by her own frustration with the world. Jenny flinched slightly, then nodded. Ruth set down the wrench she'd been holding. I'm sorry. I just mean you're so close. Don't let it beat you now. Jenny smiled a small thing that didn't quite reach her eyes. Kind of like you and these tractors. Kind of like that. The building Ruth rented sat on 2 acres of hard-packed dirt about a mile from their house. 1,200 square feet of corrugated metal with a concrete floor and overhead doors wide enough to drive a tractor through. It had been used for cotton storage before the farm crisis, then sat empty for 3 years. The owner was happy to rent it for cheap, no questions asked about what Ruth planned to do there. She had the first tractor delivered on a Wednesday afternoon. The 1963 John Deere 4020, the worst of the 14 she'd bought. A borrowed flatbed trailer brought it from the impound lot, and Ruth watched as two men from the county unloaded it using a chain hoist and a lot of swearing. The machine rolled off the trailer and sat there on her concrete floor, 4 tons of mechanical failure. The neighbor came over while Ruth stood looking at her purchase. Dorothy Pittman, 54-year-old widow who'd been running 900 acres of wheat alone since her husband died in 1985. Dot knew farming and new equipment had worked alongside her husband for 30 years before his heart attack. She walked around the 4020 twice, taking in the flat tires, the seized engine, the cracked fiberglass hood. "Ruth, honey, I know you can fix a tractor, but can you fix one that's been dead 3 years? Guess we'll find out." Dot nodded, but her face showed the kind of polite skepticism people use when they don't want to be rude. She went back to her property without saying anything else. Ruth watched her go, then turned back to the 4020. The previous owner had run it without coolant for what the seized cylinder walls suggested was the better part of a summer. 2 pistons had welded themselves to the bore. The injection pump had been replaced with an aftermarket unit that was 3 specifications wrong for the engine displacement. The cab, such as it was, an open station frame with a cracked fiberglass hood, had been used as a bird roost for long enough that the wiring harness was compromised in 11 separate places. Ruth started taking it apart on Thursday morning. She didn't have a business plan. She didn't have a spreadsheet. What she had was the notebook Jenny had left behind when she went to college. Wide-ruled and spiral-bound, now repurposed for recording every part number, every torque specification, every injection pump clearance, every valve timing sequence for every machine she was going to rebuild. The engine work took 6 weeks. She pulled the head and found the welded pistons confirming what she'd suspected from the initial inspection. The block was salvageable, but she needed new pistons, new rings, new cylinder sleeves. Parts suppliers wouldn't sell to a homeowner, only to licensed dealers. She spent 2 days making phone calls before finding Tom Hendricks, a retired dealer in Amarillo, who still had a warehouse full of 1960s inventory gathering dust. Tom didn't ask questions when Ruth called. He just confirmed part numbers and quoted prices. When she asked if he took payment from individual buyers, he laughed. "Lady, I've been trying to sell this stuff for 10 years. You got money? I got parts." She drove to Amarillo on a Saturday, Frank riding along in the passenger seat saying nothing. They loaded pistons, rings, gaskets, and seals into the truck bed. Tom showed her around his warehouse, pointing out inventory he'd accumulated over 40 years of dealing. When Ruth mentioned she needed a cylinder sleeve for the 4020, Tom walked her to the back corner where a wooden crate held exactly what she needed. She bought it for $40, one-tenth what a new sleeve would cost from a current dealer. On the drive home, Frank finally spoke. "You really think this is going to work? I think I'm going to find out." The hydraulic system came next. The 4020 ran a closed-center design different from the open-center systems on older John Deere models. The pump the previous owner had installed came from a 3020, which operated at a different pressure range. Ruth pulled the wrong pump and called dealers across West Texas trying to source the correct replacement. Most of them had never heard of anyone asking for 1960s hydraulic components. The dealer in San Angelo laughed when she explained what she needed. "Ma'am, nobody rebuilds those anymore. You're better off buying a newer machine." "I don't want a newer machine. I want this pump." He found one in his back room still in the original packaging from 1964. $55. Ruth drove to San Angelo that afternoon and had it installed by evening. She rebuilt the hydraulic cylinder on the loader arm over a weekend, Frank helping by handing her tools and holding components while she worked. The wiring harness required complete replacement. 11 compromised points, 11 places where bird droppings had corroded through the insulation and exposed bare wire. Ruth could have tried tracing each fault and repairing it individually, but that was borrowing trouble. A machine going back to work needed reliable electrical knot patch jobs that might fail during planting season. She ordered a complete harness from a supplier in Oklahoma and spent 3 days running new wire through the frame. March turned to April. April to May. The building got hot in the afternoons, the metal walls radiating heat like an oven. Ruth worked in t-shirts and jeans, hair tied back, hands black with grease by the end of each day. She came home for dinner with Frank, then went back to the shop and worked until midnight. Some nights she fell asleep on the concrete floor, waking at 2 a.m. with her cheek pressed against oil-stained cement. Frank stopped questioning the plan. Instead, he started helping. He built a workbench along one wall, installed better lighting overhead, brought her sandwiches and coffee when he finished work for the day. They didn't talk much while she worked. He just sat on an overturned bucket and watched her hands solve problems, the same hands that had been solving problems since she was 12 years old. The tires went on last. 4 used agricultural tires from a salvage yard in Sweetwater. Not new. Good enough. Ruth mounted them herself, fighting with the bead seating process until her shoulders ached and her hands cramped. By the time she finished, it was late June, 4 months since the auction. She filled the engine with oil, checked the coolant level, connected the battery. The 4020 sat in her shop, looking almost functional, a transformation from the seized hulk that had rolled off the trailer in March. Ruth walked around it 3 times, checking connections, looking for anything she might have missed. Finding nothing, she climbed into the open station seat. The starter turned slow on the first crank. The engine turned over but didn't catch. Second crank, same result. Third crank, the diesel fired and the whole machine shuddered as combustion found its rhythm. Ruth let it idle, watching the temperature gauge, watching the oil pressure, listening for the knock that would tell her a bearing wasn't seated right or a clearance was off. There was no knock. There was nothing but the sound of a diesel engine doing exactly what a diesel engine was supposed to do. The sound of machinery that had been dead for 3 years now alive again because someone had taken the time to understand what it needed. She let it idle for 45 minutes. The temperature stabilized. The oil pressure held steady. No smoke from the exhaust beyond the initial startup haze. No unusual vibrations. No warning signs of hidden problems waiting to surface. When she finally shut it down, the silence felt heavier than it should have. Ruth sat in the seat for a few minutes, hands still on the steering wheel, feeling something she hadn't felt since December. Not pride, exactly. More like proof. Proof that she could still do this. Proof that 39 years of knowledge counted for something. Proof that the world's opinion of her mattered less than what her hands could build. She drove the 4020 out of the building and across her property, testing the steering, the brakes, the hydraulics. Everything worked. Everything she'd rebuilt from scattered parts and careful attention now functioned as a cohesive machine. She drove it back into the shop and shut it down. Then she went inside and called Dot Pittman. The phone rang 4 times before Dot picked up. "You want to rent a tractor for fall harvest?" Dot was quiet for a moment, the kind of pause that meant she was thinking through implications. "I already have my own equipment. Mine's $800 for the season, all maintenance included. What if it breaks down? I fix it. That's the deal." Dot was silent again longer this time. In West Texas in 1987, renting agricultural equipment wasn't a standard arrangement. Farmers either owned their machines or bought used through dealers. The rental market was thin, mostly limited to specialized equipment for short-term needs. Nobody rented basic tractors for an entire season. "I'll think about it. Take your time." Ruth hung up and went back to the shop. She had 13 more tractors to rebuild, but the first one was done. The 1963 John Deere 4020 bought for $400 at a government auction, now worth at least $4,000 if she wanted to sell it. But she didn't want to sell it. She wanted to rent it. Wanted to prove that her model could work, wanted to show that there was another way to do this, besides ownership and debt and the constant pressure of equipment loans. 3 days later, Dot drove over in her pickup truck. She parked in front of the shop and sat there for a minute before getting out. When she finally emerged, she walked around the 4020 twice, checking the hydraulics on the loader, pulling the dipstick, looking at the tires. She spent 20 minutes inspecting every accessible component, running her hands over rebuilt parts, testing connections. "My husband taught me to check dipsticks before I check smiles. You pass both tests." Dot agreed to one season fall harvest only. She'd pay $400 up front, $400 on completion. If the tractor worked the way Ruth claimed, she'd consider renewing for the following year. If it broke down, they'd renegotiate. Ruth stuck out her hand. Dot shook it, her grip firm and calloused from 3 decades of farm work. That was July 1987. Ruth Ann Coleman had just rented her first tractor. She had 13 more to rebuild. The business model. If anyone had bothered to ask Ruth what it was, came down to 3 things. Buy broken equipment nobody else wanted. Fix it better than it had been when it was new. Rent it to people who needed reliability more than they needed modern features. The rental covered the machine's cost in 18 months. Everything after that was profit, except Ruth never thought of it as profit. She thought of it as proving a point. By the end of 1988, she had 6 tractors rented to 5 different farming operations. Dot Pittman had renewed her contract without hesitation after the 4020 worked through fall harvest without a single failure. She'd even asked about renting a second machine for spring planting. Ruth had the 1961 International 560 ready by March, rebuilt over the winter with the same methodical attention she'd given the 4020. Dot took it for the season and paid cash up front. Word moved the way it always moved in rural Texas, slowly at first, then suddenly. Carl Henderson, who farmed 600 acres of cotton north of Abilene, heard about Ruth from Dot at a Farm Bureau meeting. He called in April 1989, asking if she had anything available for planting season. Ruth had just finished rebuilding a 1965 Minneapolis Moline G705 that the auction catalog had listed simply as non-operational. She quoted him $900 for the season, all maintenance included. Carl asked what happened if the tractor broke down during a critical window. "I'll be there within 4 hours, day or night." Carl thought about it for 2 days, then agreed. The Moline ran through his entire cotton planting without issue. When he returned it in June, he asked about reserving it again for the following year. The phone number Ruth gave to renters was their home line, the same number Frank used for his insurance business. She had an answering machine installed, but she rarely let calls go to it during planting and harvest seasons. Spring and fall, she kept the phone within arm's reach every waking hour. She slept light, trained herself to wake at the first ring. Frank adjusted, learned to sleep through the midnight calls that came every few weeks during peak season. The call came at 2:47 on a Thursday morning in June of 1989. Ruth picked up before the second ring, already swinging her legs out of bed. Carl Henderson's voice came through tight with stress. Hydraulic line blew on the Moline. "I'm down. Which line loader circuit looks like the pressure side? I'll be there in 40 minutes. She dressed in the dark, grabbed her truck keys and a flashlight. Frank stirred but didn't wake. Ruth had a road kit already packed in the truck bed, basic tools and common replacement parts organized in metal boxes. She'd learned to anticipate failures, stock the components most likely to need emergency replacement. For the Moline, that meant hydraulic lines cut to common lengths, spare fittings, extra fluid. She made the drive to Carl's place in 38 minutes faster than she should have on county roads in the dark. His farmyard lights were on when she pulled in, and Carl stood next to the disabled Moline with a trouble light illuminating the failed line. Ruth could see the problem before she got out of the truck. Pressure side hydraulic line, exactly as he'd said, blown at a fitting that had been crimped wrong during the original installation decades ago. The fitting had finally fatigued through. She had the replacement line out of her truck and the failed section removed in 15 minutes. The new line went in clean, proper crimp fittings on both ends, torqued to specification. She bled the system, tested the loader function, checked for leaks under pressure. Total repair time, 32 minutes. Carl stood watching, his exhaustion visible even in the harsh work light. "How'd you know what size line to bring? I put it in. I know what fails." Carl paid her the full seasonal rental fee the next morning, then asked if she had anything available for his fall harvest. She promised him the 1968 Oliver 185, she'd been rebuilding since March. By 1990, Ruth had 11 tractors in active rental rotation. She'd been back to government auctions 3 more times, each time buying machines that other dealers wouldn't touch. A pair of 1968 Oliver 1850s pulled from a creek bottom pasture, their frames showing surface rust through deteriorated paint. A 1970, Case 97, with a transmission destroyed by someone who'd run it without adequate lubrication. A 1966 John Deere 302, that had been sitting in a county impound lot since 1985, its fuel system completely fouled by degraded diesel. She fixed them all. The work consumed every hour she wasn't sleeping or eating. Frank handled the administrative side, maintaining a calendar that tracked every rented machine, every scheduled maintenance interval, every customer commitment. The calendar lived on their kitchen wall, a large grid showing the entire year at a glance. During planting and harvest seasons, nearly every square had notations in Frank's careful handwriting. He never slept during those peak windows, not really. From April through June, and again from September through November, Ruth lived in a state of perpetual motion. She was either in the shop rebuilding something or in her truck responding to a call. The space between those two activities barely existed. Frank kept coffee brewing 24 hours a day, brought her food she often forgot to eat, answered the phone when she was elbow deep in a transmission rebuild. The agricultural equipment industry was changing around them in ways that should have made Ruth's operation obsolete. By 1990, GPS guidance systems were hitting the commercial market. Companies like Ag Navigation and Trimble were selling receivers that promised precision agriculture satellite-assisted planting that could reduce seed waste and increase yields. The systems cost $15,000 per unit, required dealer installation that took 2 to 3 days, and delivered accuracy within about 3 meters. For West Texas cotton farming, where row spacing mattered down to inches, 3 meters was barely adequate. Every equipment dealer in the region had brochures for GPS systems in their waiting rooms. Every farm magazine ran features about the coming revolution in precision agriculture. The future, according to industry publications, belonged to farmers who embraced technology and invested in modern equipment platforms capable of interfacing with satellite guidance. Ruth's phone kept ringing with farmers who needed their 1965 Minneapolis Moline fixed before dawn. The disconnect between what the industry said farmers needed and what farmers actually called her about was so wide you could drive a combine through it. The reason was money, mostly. Case IH released the Magnum series in 1990, modern tractors with turbocharged engines, power shift transmissions, climate-controlled cabs and hydraulic systems designed to integrate with the coming generation of precision implements. A new Magnum 7140 listed at $78,000. For a farmer running 600 acres, that was a mortgage-level investment. For a farmer running 600 acres who'd survived the farm crisis by the skin of his teeth, that was an impossible investment. Banks in 1990 weren't eager to finance agricultural equipment purchases. The crisis was only 3 years past, and lending institutions had long memories about foreclosures and losses. A farmer who wanted a Magnum needed either substantial cash reserves or a credit history pristine enough to convince a banker that this time would be different. Most of Ruth's customers had neither. What they had was acreage that needed planting and crops that needed harvesting work that required functional power equipment, regardless of how old that equipment might be. Ruth's tractors were paid for. Ruth's phone number was available 24 hours. When something broke at 2 in the morning during a critical weather window, Ruth showed up with parts and tools and got the machine running before daylight cost the farmer his planting schedule. The dealerships couldn't match that. Their service departments ran skeleton crews even during peak season. Parts were frequently back-ordered, and a farmer with a broken tractor could be looking at 5 to 7 days of downtime. In agricultural work, every day of delay during planting or harvest season translated directly to lost yield. Plant too late, and your cotton matured during suboptimal weather. Harvest too late, and you risked crop degradation in the field. Ruth's promise of 4-hour response time had actual dollar value. It meant the difference between planting on schedule and missing your window. It meant the difference between bringing in your wheat before a storm and watching rain damage your crop while you waited for a dealership mechanic to return your call. In 1993, Frank insisted they formalize the business structure. They'd been operating under Ruth's name for tax purposes, but as the operation grew, they needed proper legal standing. They registered Coleman Equipment Services with the county, opened a business checking account, started keeping receipts organized in a filing system that Frank set up in their spare bedroom. The filing cabinet held service records for every machine, each tractor's complete history from acquisition through every rental period and every repair. Ruth maintained these records herself, handwritten logs that tracked parts replaced hours, operated problems reported by renters. When a machine came back at the end of a rental season, Ruth inspected it against its service record. She didn't rely on the renter to tell her what needed work. She knew what to expect based on how the machine had performed previously, what its weak points were, what components were approaching the end of their service life. Then she rebuilt whatever needed rebuilding before the tractor went back out. This wasn't standard practice in the rental industry. Most equipment rental operations expected renters to handle basic maintenance and return machines in roughly the condition they'd received them normal wear accepted. Ruth's contract said the opposite. The machine was hers. The maintenance was her responsibility. The renter's only job was to operate it and report anything that felt wrong. In practice, this meant Ruth spent more time maintaining her fleet than a traditional rental business would, but it also meant her uptime rate was substantially higher. A farmer who rented from Ruth knew the machine had been thoroughly inspected and serviced before it reached his property. He knew that if something did go wrong, Ruth would respond immediately. He knew that his only risk was the seasonal rental fee, not the hidden costs of maintenance and repair that came with ownership. By the end of 1993, Ruth had built a customer base of 19 farming operations across 3 counties. Her fleet had grown to 23 machines. She'd bought a second metal building, this one 2,400 square feet, to handle the heavier rebuilding work. Engine overhauls and transmission rebuilds moved to the larger space. The original 1,200 square foot building became dedicated to parts storage and electrical work. The business was profitable, though Ruth and Frank drew minimal income from it. Most revenue went back into acquiring and rebuilding additional machines. Frank kept working his insurance business, his income covering their living expenses, while Coleman Equipment Services grew. They'd built something sustainable, something that served a real need, something that proved a 51-year-old woman fired from her job could create value the market actually wanted. Spring of 1994 arrived with the kind of weather that made farmers nervous. Late freeze warnings through March, then sudden heat in early April that accelerated planting schedules. Everyone rushed to get seeds in the ground during a compressed optimal window. Ruth had 19 tractors out on rental contracts, and her phone started ringing before dawn most days, with farmers reporting minor issues or requesting pre-planting inspections. 3 tractors went down during a 2-week span in late April. Not catastrophically, not in ways that would alarm someone unfamiliar with mechanical systems, but in ways that told Ruth she was approaching the limits of what deferred component aging could be managed through regular maintenance alone. The 1961 International 560 developed a bearing knock in the final drive. Not an emergency failure, but the kind of progressive wear that would become one if left unaddressed through another season. The 1966 John Deere 3020 started showing governor issues, fuel delivery inconsistency at high load that was manageable now, but getting worse each week. The Oliver 1850 had a crack developing in the cast iron of the rear axle housing that Ruth found during a routine inspection. That crack meant the machine could not be rented, period. All 3 tractors were in active service with farmers mid-planting season. Ruth made the calls, personally explaining the situation to each operator. She had loaners available machines she'd been holding back while finishing their rebuilds. She spent 17 hours over 4 days managing the transitions, delivering replacement tractors, and retrieving the failed units. Gerald Fuchs ran 640 acres of grain sorghum outside Big Spring. He'd been renting the Oliver for 2 seasons. Never had a problem with it. Trusted it completely. When Ruth showed up at his farm with a trailer to pull the Oliver and a different tractor to leave in its place, his face showed the kind of anger that came from frustration more than malice. "I've got a window. I don't have 2 days to wait for a machine swap. You've got one now." Ruth had the replacement ready on the trailer behind her truck, a 1967 John Deere 4020 she'd rebuilt over the winter. New cab enclosure sourced from a salvage yard in New Mexico painted herself to match the original green. It wasn't new, but it was functional, and it was sitting in Gerald's driveway while they were having this conversation. Gerald looked at the 4020 for a long moment, his jaw working like he was chewing through his options. Finally, he climbed onto the machine and drove it toward his field without another word. Ruth watched him go, then loaded the Oliver onto her trailer and brought it back to the shop. The crack in the axle housing required welding, but cast iron. Welding was tricky work that needed specialty equipment Ruth didn't have. She found a machine shop in Abilene that could handle it, paid them $200 to do the repair properly. The bearing replacement on the International took her 3 full days of work pulling the final drive completely apart and rebuilding it from the differential out. The governor issue on the 3020 required sourcing a replacement component from a dealer in Lubbock who hadn't stocked that part in 15 years but found one in his back room covered in dust. All 3 repairs consumed time and money Ruth hadn't budgeted for that month. The business had reserves enough to cover unexpected costs, but 3 simultaneous failures stretched those reserves thinner than Frank was comfortable with. He didn't say anything directly, just started doing the math on his yellow legal pad late at night, calculating how many more emergency repairs they could handle before they needed to dip into their personal savings. Then Jenny came home. Ruth was in the shop on a Tuesday afternoon rebuilding the International's final drive when she heard a car pull into the driveway. She recognized the sound of Jenny's Toyota distinctive from the rattle in its exhaust system that her daughter had been meaning to fix for months. But Jenny wasn't supposed to be home. She had her accounting job in Dallas, had been there since graduating college 2 years ago. Ruth wiped her hands on a shop rag and walked outside. Jenny sat in her car with the engine off, both hands on the steering wheel, staring straight ahead through the windshield. Ruth tapped on the driver's window. Jenny turned, and Ruth could see she'd been crying. The whole story came out over the next hour, sitting at the kitchen table while Frank poured coffee. Neither of them drank. Jenny had quit her job 3 weeks ago after her supervisor accused her of making an accounting error that cost the firm a client. The error wasn't Jenny's, but she couldn't prove it, and the supervisor needed someone to blame. She'd left before they could fire her, which meant no severance and no reference. But that wasn't the worst part. The worst part was the debt. $18,000 in credit card balances accumulated over 2 years of trying to maintain a lifestyle Dallas expected from young professionals. The apartment in a good neighborhood, the work wardrobe, the happy hours, and networking dinners that weren't really optional if you wanted to advance. Jenny had been covering the minimum payments, but without her salary, she was 60 days from default. There was more. She'd been engaged to a man she'd met through work, had been planning a wedding for September. That ended when she told him about the debt. He'd called her financially irresponsible, said he couldn't marry someone who managed money that poorly. The breakup happened the same week she lost her job. Jenny cried while she talked, the kind of crying that came from total exhaustion. Ruth sat across from her, listening, feeling anger build in her chest at the supervisor who'd scapegoated her daughter, at the fiancé who'd bailed when things got hard, at the entire system that demanded young people perform prosperity they couldn't afford. Frank's reaction was immediate. They'd help with the debt, figure out a payment plan, get Jenny back on her feet. Family came first. Ruth understood the impulse, wanted to help her daughter, but the timing was catastrophic. The business had just absorbed 3 expensive repairs. They had seasonal rental income coming, but that wouldn't arrive for months. Their personal savings were meant for emergencies, but $18,000 was a different category of emergency than they'd planned for. The argument happened after Jenny went to bed exhausted from the drive and the confession. Frank stood at the kitchen counter, his voice carefully controlled in the way it got when he was working hard not to shout. "Jenny needs us. The business can wait. If I don't fix those tractors now, we lose those customers forever. Then, what do we help Jenny with? You're choosing tractors over your daughter." The words landed like a punch. Ruth felt something crack inside her. The careful balance she'd maintained between being a mother and being a business owner suddenly impossible to sustain. "I'm choosing to keep a business that can help our daughter. That can help all of us. If we drain our savings now, what happens when the next emergency comes? What happens when another 3 tractors go down simultaneously? This business is the only thing standing between us and the same crisis that took down half the farms in Texas." Frank was quiet for a long moment. When he spoke again, his voice had lost its edge. "So what do we do?" "We work. I fix the tractors. You keep the books. We get through the season. Then we figure out Jenny's debt. They went to bed without resolving anything, laying next to each other in the dark with 3 feet of emotional distance between them. Ruth couldn't sleep. She kept running numbers in her head, calculating how much the repairs would cost against projected seasonal revenue. The math was tight but workable, assuming no more failures and assuming all her current renters paid on time. Jenny stayed. She didn't ask permission, just moved her stuff into her old bedroom and started looking for work in Abilene. The job market wasn't good. She applied to accounting firms, bookkeeping services, even retail positions. Nothing materialized. After 2 weeks of rejections, she approached Ruth with a proposal. "Let me do your books. Properly. I've been looking at your filing system and it's disorganized. You're losing money because you don't track expenses correctly. You're probably overpaying taxes because you're not claiming legitimate business deductions. Let me fix it. I can't pay you. Call it working off my debt, to you and to myself." Ruth looked at her daughter, this young woman who'd come home defeated and was now trying to find a way to contribute. The business did need better accounting. Frank did his best, but his insurance training hadn't prepared him for tracking equipment depreciation and maintenance costs across 2 dozen machines. "All right, show me what you can do." Jenny spent the next week going through every receipt, every service record, every rental contract in the filing cabinet. She built a spreadsheet on their home computer, categorizing expenses, tracking income by machine, and by customer, calculating actual profit margins for each piece of equipment. When she showed Ruth the results, the numbers were sobering. "You're making money, but barely. Your maintenance costs are eating 38% of rental income. Industry standard is 22%. You're over-maintaining." "I maintain what needs maintaining. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm saying you need to charge more or accept lower margins. At your current rate structure, one bad year wipes you out." Ruth studied the spreadsheet, seeing her business reduced to numbers that didn't account for relationships or reliability or the value of answering the phone at 2 in the morning. But the numbers didn't lie. She was running too close to the edge. "What do you recommend? Raise rates 10%. Add a surcharge for emergency service calls. Stop eating your time and mileage costs." Ruth thought about her customers. Farmers operating on margins just as thin as hers, people who trusted her because she didn't nickel and dime them for every service call. "I'm not charging farmers extra for emergency calls. That's part of the deal." "Then you need to reduce maintenance costs or accept that you're running a charity." "It's not charity. It's insurance. Every dollar I spend on maintenance is a dollar I don't spend on catastrophic failures during peak season." Jenny closed the laptop and looked at her mother with something like understanding. "You really believe that I know that? 39 years of working on machines teaches you that prevention costs less than repair." They compromised. Ruth agreed to a 5% rate increase for new contracts, grandfathering existing customers at their current rates. Jenny would take over all bookkeeping and administrative work, organizing the chaos of Ruth's record keeping into something the IRS wouldn't question. In exchange, Jenny lived at home rent-free while she rebuilt her finances and her life. The arrangement worked. Jenny discovered she was good at the business side of equipment. Rental had a talent for scheduling and customer communication that complemented Ruth's mechanical expertise. By fall of 1994, Coleman Equipment Services had clean books, better cash flow management, and a daughter who'd found purpose in the work her mother had built. The competition arrived in 1995, though Ruth didn't recognize it as competition at first. AgriLease Corporation opened a regional office in Abilene in March, a national equipment rental company with capital backing and ambitions to expand throughout Texas. They leased a commercial building on the highway, professional signage, and a parking lot, and a service manager who wore a company polo shirt to work. Their fleet consisted of late-model tractors machines from the 1980s and early 1990s with enclosed cabs and modern hydraulics. They ran advertisements in the local paper and sent direct mail brochures to every farming operation in the county. Their rental rates were higher than Ruth's, sometimes significantly so, but they sold convenience and professionalism and equipment that looked like what farmers saw in dealer showrooms. The regional manager was a woman named Diane Shepherd, 36 years old, MBA from Texas Tech, sent from Dallas corporate to establish the market. She drove a new Chevy Silverado with the AgriLease logo on the door and dressed like someone who'd learned about farming from trade publications rather than dirt. Ruth heard about AgriLease from Carl Henderson, who'd received their direct mail package, and wanted to know if she was worried about the competition. She wasn't, not really. Her customers valued relationships and reliability over professional presentation. They rented from her because she answered the phone and fixed their problems, not because her shop looked impressive. The first 6 months proved her right. AgriLease signed 7 new customers, all farmers who'd never used equipment rental before and were attracted by the modern machines and professional marketing. Ruth lost 0 customers. Her existing base stayed loyal, renewed their contracts without hesitation. Diane Shepherd noticed. By fall of 1995, she was asking questions around town, trying to understand why AgriLease wasn't capturing the established rental market. She drove by Ruth's property, saw the 2 metal buildings and the tractors in various states of service. She talked to farmers at Farm Bureau meetings, asked casual questions about their equipment sources. What she learned frustrated her. The woman mechanic operating out of a shed had somehow captured customer loyalty that AgriLease's superior resources and modern equipment couldn't overcome. Diane reported back to Dallas that the market was more difficult than projected, that local relationships mattered more than corporate efficiency. Dallas gave her a year to turn it around. Spring 1996 brought Diane's first strategic move, a price promotion 30% off first-year rental on any new or late model machine. The offer targeted Ruth's 11 longest tenured customers by name direct mail packages that emphasized AgriLease's advantages. Modern equipment, GPS-ready platforms, professional service infrastructure, and now competitive pricing. 8 of those 11 customers renewed with Ruth instead. The 9th, a younger farmer who'd taken over his father's operation and wanted precision agriculture capability, signed with AgriLease. The other 2 took the promotional pricing but came back to Ruth the following year. Diane escalated. At Farm Bureau meetings and agricultural co-op gatherings, she started dropping comments that sounded helpful but carried implications. Concerns about reliability when equipment maintenance depended on one person. Questions about whether a woman working alone could handle heavy mechanical work like transmission replacement. Suggestions that farmers might want to consider service capacity when choosing rental providers. The rumors reached Ruth through Jenny, who overheard a conversation at the feed store. 2 farmers discussing whether to try AgriLease because it seemed more professional, more reliable than depending on one woman mechanic who might not be able to keep up with demand. Jenny came home angry, ready for Ruth to confront Diane directly. But Ruth's response was quieter, more calculated. "We don't fight talk with talk. We fight talk with work." She doubled down on service, started carrying more spare parts in her truck, organized by the machines currently out on rental. Cut her response time from 4 hours to under 2 hours on average. Added a new service offering free pre-season inspections for all customers. The farmers who received those inspections appreciated the attention, the sense that Ruth cared about their success beyond collecting rental fees. The counterattack won customers not through confrontation but through demonstrated value. Carl Henderson, who'd briefly considered switching to AgriLease, had a hydraulic system failure on one of their rented tractors during wheat harvest in June 1996. He called their service line and was told someone would be out Tuesday. It was Thursday. Carl called Ruth, even though he wasn't renting her equipment that season. She arrived 90 minutes later, diagnosed the problem, fixed it temporarily to get him through his harvest window, and didn't charge him anything. "What do I owe you? Nothing. But if you want to rent from me next year, call." Carl switched back to Ruth in 1997. So did Gerald Fuchs, who'd tried AgriLease's newer equipment, but missed the certainty that when something went wrong, Ruth would show up before the problem cost him money. By fall of 1997, Ruth had 15 active customers, up from 13 the previous year. AgriLease had 9 down from 11. Diane Shepherd tried deeper price cuts, 40% off promotional rates that barely covered AgriLease's overhead costs. She attracted 2 new customers, both small operators with limited acreage. Dallas corporate started questioning the return on investment, asking why the Abilene market wasn't scaling the way their models predicted. Diane got 1 year to demonstrate growth, or the office would be reassessed. It makes you wonder how many innovations never happen because we decide in advance who's allowed to innovate. The validation came from an unexpected source. The USDA published a report in July 1997 on agricultural equipment access in rural communities. The report identified equipment availability, specifically the gap between what small and mid-sized farming operations needed during peak seasonal windows and what they could afford to own or access through traditional dealers, as a significant constraint on production efficiency in the Southern Plains states. Buried in the appendices was a case study. A rental operation in Taylor County, Texas, had developed what the researchers described as a relationship-based maintenance model that achieved unusually high equipment uptime during peak operational periods. The study didn't name Coleman Equipment Services directly, but anyone familiar with the area would recognize the description. Ruth read the report at the kitchen table, Jenny sitting across from her with a cup of coffee going cold between her hands. The academic language felt foreign words like infrastructure and operational efficiency used to describe what Ruth thought of simply as doing the job right. But underneath the jargon was recognition that what she'd built mattered, that it solved real problems in ways traditional approaches didn't. Someone thinks we're worth studying. Mom, someone thinks you're proving the entire industry wrong. A month later, a woman named Dr. Patricia Holloway knocked on Ruth's door. She had a Ph.D. in agricultural economics from Texas A&M, had been studying equipment access barriers in rural Texas farming communities for 7 years. She'd read the USDA report and tracked down Coleman Equipment Services through county business registrations. She wanted to document Ruth's operation for academic research. Ruth's first instinct was to say no. She didn't have time for interviews, and studies didn't see what there was to document beyond fixing tractors and keeping promises. But Dr. Holloway was persistent in a way that reminded Ruth of herself, polite but unwilling to accept refusal. "I've been looking for an operation like yours for 3 years. Nobody else is doing this. Nobody else has figured out how to make small-scale equipment rental economically viable while maintaining the service levels farmers actually need. I just fix tractors and rent them. That's exactly the point." Dr. Holloway spent 4 days at the property that September. She sat with Jenny going through the filing cabinet, reading every service record, every rental contract, every parts invoice dating back to March 1987. She interviewed Ruth in the evenings after shop work ended, asking questions about decision-making processes and maintenance philosophy and customer relationship management. She called 6 of Ruth's renters, documented their experiences, their satisfaction levels, their reasons for choosing Coleman Equipment Services over alternatives. What she found and what she eventually published in a 1998 paper in the Journal of Agricultural Economics was this: Ruth Coleman had built over 11 years, without formal business training or outside capital, a functional rural equipment rental and maintenance cooperative that had served 43 distinct farming operations across 4 counties while achieving an average equipment uptime rate during peak planting and harvest windows of 94.7%. The industry average for comparable equipment at that time was 71%. The difference, 23.7 percentage points of additional uptime, translated across Ruth's customer base to an estimated $1.2 million in additional productivity per year. Crops planted on schedule. Harvests completed before weather windows closed. Ground worked when soil conditions were optimal, rather than when equipment happened to be available. But what the research paper didn't capture, what no data could measure, was the moment Ruth read her own work described as innovative agricultural infrastructure. She was sitting in her shop at 10 p.m., covered in hydraulic fluid from rebuilding a cylinder, and she started crying. Frank found her an hour later, the academic paper open on her workbench. Her eyes red, but her face showing something he hadn't seen since before Morrison's had fired her. Pride, maybe, or vindication, or just the simple acknowledgement that 11 years of answering the phone at 2 in the morning had meant something beyond her own survival. Ruth read the paper twice, then called Dr. Holloway with one correction. It wasn't 41 operations. Jenny counted. It was 43. Dr. Holloway published an erratum. Ruth taped the original paper to the inside of her shop door, right where she could see it while working. She didn't frame it or preserve it carefully. She just wanted it visible, a reminder that what looked like common sense to her looked like innovation to people who studied these things professionally. The paper yellowed over the following months got spotted with grease its corners curling in the West Texas heat. Ruth never replaced it. The deterioration felt appropriate, somehow proof that the work continued regardless of recognition. The years between 1998 and 2005 were the steady years, the kind that don't make headlines but build foundations solid enough to support what comes after. The fleet grew to 31 machines. Ruth bought the second metal building in 1999, 2,400 square feet of workspace that allowed her to separate heavy rebuilding from routine maintenance. Engine overhauls and transmission work moved to the larger facility. The original building became dedicated storage for parts and electrical components organized in bins labeled with Ruth's precise handwriting. But steady didn't mean unchanging. Late 1998 brought news that rearranged everything Ruth thought she understood about the future. Frank was 64 when the neurologist delivered the diagnosis. Parkinson's disease, early stage, probably 2 to 3 years of symptoms he'd been attributing to normal aging, the tremor in his left hand that he'd dismissed as fatigue, the stiffness in his shoulders he'd blamed on sleeping wrong, the slight shuffle in his gait that Ruth had noticed but hadn't mentioned because mentioning it felt like acknowledging something neither of them wanted to face. The doctor laid out the trajectory with clinical precision. 5 to 10 good years, maybe more with proper medication management. Progressive motor function, decline. Cognitive function typically preserved until late stages. No cure, only symptom management. Frank needed to plan accordingly. They sat in the truck in the hospital parking lot for 20 minutes after the appointment, neither speaking. Finally, Frank turned to look at Ruth, his face showing acceptance rather than fear. I guess we're both breaking down. You're not a tractor. Same principle, though. Things wear out. You rebuild what you can, replace what you can't. The impact on Coleman Equipment Services was immediate but subtle. Frank's tremor made detailed scheduling work difficult. His handwriting, once careful and precise, became shakier. The calendar system he'd maintained on the kitchen wall became Jenny's responsibility. She took it over without discussion, understanding that her father's dignity mattered more than acknowledging his limitations. Ruth was 62 that year, feeling her own body's response to decades of mechanical work. Arthritis had started in her hands around 1997, making morning stiffness a regular companion. She could still work, still rebuild engines and hydraulic systems, but recovery took longer. A full day in the shop meant evenings with swollen knuckles and aching shoulders. She started keeping ibuprofen in her truck, taking it prophylactically before heavy jobs. The realization hit her one morning while rebuilding a transmission. She needed help with the physical work. Not supervision, not training, just another set of hands capable of doing the heavy lifting she could no longer sustain alone. The business had revenue to support hiring someone part-time, and Ruth's body was making it clear that part-time help needed to become full-time sooner rather than later. She found Tommy Lawson through the VOTEC program at Abilene High School. 19 years old, grew up on a small farm outside town, had been working on equipment since his father put tools in his hands at age 12. The school's automotive instructor recommended him, mentioned that Tommy had mechanical intuition, unusual for someone so young. Ruth hired him for weekends and summers, 15 hours a week at $9 an hour. His job was simple: do what Ruth told him to do, lift what she couldn't lift, learn everything he could about how machines communicated their problems. Tommy was a good student, eager and attentive. But he was also temporary, a kid who'd graduate and move on to something with better pay and more stability than seasonal work for a woman running tractors out of a metal shed. By 2000, Ruth understood she needed someone permanent, someone she could train properly, someone who might eventually take over the physical work entirely, while she transitioned to diagnostics and customer management, someone who could be taught not just to fix machines, but to listen to them. Marcus Webb showed up unannounced on a Saturday morning in June 1999. 22 years old, drove a beat-up Ford Ranger with 200,000 miles showing on the odometer. He found Ruth in the shop working on a hydraulic pump, and he waited until she finished before speaking. "I heard you might need a mechanic." Ruth looked him over. Work boots worn, but maintained jeans with grease stains that suggested actual experience rather than affectation, hands that showed calluses in the right places. Who told you that? Nobody. But you're running 28 tractors and you're doing it alone. That's not sustainable. The directness appealed to Ruth. Too many young people danced around what they wanted, tried to seem casual about opportunities they desperately needed. Marcus just stated the obvious and waited for her response. She tested him with a hydraulic pump she'd pulled that morning, a unit with a bearing failure that had created secondary damage in the valve body. She handed it to him without explanation. What's wrong with this? Marcus turned the pump over in his hands, examining the housing, the shaft, the mounting surface. He spun the drive shaft carefully, feeling for resistance. Then he looked up. Main bearing failed. Probably ran hot before it seized. You've got metal contamination in the valve body now. Needs complete tear down and cleaning new bearings. Check all clearances. Ruth hired him on the spot. $14 an hour full-time, start Monday. The first year was difficult in ways Ruth hadn't anticipated. Marcus knew mechanics understood diesel engines and hydraulic systems and electrical troubleshooting, but he thought like a dealership mechanic trained to diagnose and replace rather than understand and prevent. Ruth needed to retrain those instincts, teach him that maintenance wasn't about fixing broken things, but about listening to machines before they broke. She started him on service records. Every machine in the fleet had a complete history, handwritten logs dating back to acquisition. Ruth made Marcus read these records before touching any equipment, made him understand a tractor's past before working on its present. This isn't a log of what happened. It's a story of what the machine is telling you about what it needs next. Marcus struggled with the concept initially. He wanted clear diagnostic procedures, step-by-step processes he could follow to consistent results. Ruth's approach seemed too intuitive, too dependent on experience he didn't have. The breakthrough came 6 months in. Ruth sent him to service a 1970 Case 970 that had been out on rental for 3 months. The farmer reported no problems, but the machine was due for routine inspection. Marcus came back with his report, everything checked out, all systems operating within normal parameters. Ruth asked about the oil analysis. Marcus had checked the level, confirmed it was full and clean-looking. Ruth asked about the color, the smell, the viscosity. Marcus went back to look again, this time paying attention to qualities beyond pass-fail metrics. When he returned, his face showed understanding. There's metal in it. Fine particles. Nothing obvious, but it's there. What does that tell you? Something's wearing that shouldn't be. Probably transmission bearings starting to fail. They pulled the transmission the next day. Marcus was right. Two bearings showed early stage wear that would have become catastrophic failure within another month of operation. Ruth let Marcus do the rebuild under her supervision, walking him through proper clearance measurements and assembly procedures. When they finished, she could see something had shifted in how he approached the work. By 2001, Marcus was handling service calls independently. Ruth still supervised complex rebuilds, but routine maintenance and minor repairs became his domain. His diagnostic skills improved rapidly once he started listening to machines instead of just measuring them. Within 3 years, he was rebuilding engines. Within 5, Ruth trusted him with work she wouldn't have delegated to dealership mechanics with twice his experience. Frank watched this progression with quiet satisfaction. His Parkinson's was advancing slowly but noticeably. By 2001, he needed a cane for stability. By 2003, his medication regimen had become complicated enough that Jenny managed it with a pill organizer and strict schedules. He could still work, still handled customer phone calls and basic administrative tasks, but his role in the business was diminishing as his disease progressed. One evening in 2002, Frank sat at the kitchen table watching Ruth and Marcus through the window. They were in the yard examining a tractor's rear axle, Marcus pointing at something while Ruth nodded. Frank turned to Jenny. "Marcus is your mother's succession plan." Jenny looked up from the accounting she was reviewing. Her father's face showed something beyond observation, a kind of relief that came from seeing the future arranged properly. "Mom's not retiring." "I didn't say she was. I said he's her insurance." AgRelease Corporation closed its Abilene office in October 2002. Diane Shepherd had been transferred back to Dallas in 2000 after failing to meet growth projections for 3 consecutive quarters. A different manager took over, ran the operation for 2 more years, with equally disappointing results. corporate finally decided the market wasn't scaling the way their business model required. The failure wasn't about competition with Ruth, though that's how some people interpreted it. The real problem was structural. AgriLease needed high volume to justify their overhead costs. The commercial building lease, the fleet of modern equipment, the salaried staff. They required 100-plus rental contracts annually to break even on their operational expenses. West Texas didn't have that many farmers interested in equipment rental, and the ones who were interested valued relationships over professional presentation. Their service model created additional problems. AgriLease operated on scheduled appointments, business hours, standard procedures designed for efficiency at scale. But agricultural work didn't respect business hours. A farmer with a broken tractor at 2 in the morning during harvest season needed immediate response, not an appointment for the following Tuesday. AgriLease's systems couldn't accommodate that kind of flexibility without undermining their entire operational structure. Modern equipment helped initially attracted customers who wanted GPS-ready platforms and climate-controlled cabs. But modern equipment broke down just as frequently as older machines. And when it did, AgriLease's service response was identical to their competitors. 3 to 5 days turnaround parts on backorder mechanics who treated farmers like customers rather than partners. Ruth heard about the closure from Carl Henderson, who drove by the empty building and saw contractors removing the AgriLease signage. She didn't comment, just went back to work. Jenny asked later if she felt vindicated. Nobody won. They just didn't understand what farmers need. But AgriLease's departure didn't mean Ruth's challenges were over. By 2003, a different problem was emerging, one that couldn't be solved with better service or more reliable equipment. The customer base was changing. The farmers who'd rented from Ruth in 1988 were now in their late 50s and 60s. Some were passing operations to children who had different ideas about equipment management. Some were selling out, retiring, moving to town. Some were expanding, acquiring neighboring parcels, and scaling up from 600-acre operations to 1,200-acre enterprises. The larger operations didn't need Ruth's services anymore. At that scale, owning modern equipment made financial sense. They had revenue to justify the investment, credit access to secure financing, and enough acreage to amortize equipment costs across meaningful production volumes. They wanted GPS guidance, precision agriculture capabilities, the technological advantages Ruth's rebuilt vintage tractors couldn't provide. Ruth's market was shrinking to a specific segment, mid-tier operations. 300 to 800 acres too large to work without reliable power equipment, but too small to efficiently own and maintain a full modern fleet. This segment was getting smaller every year as agricultural consolidation accelerated. Small farms failed or sold out. Large farms absorbed them. The middle ground where Ruth's business thrived was eroding. Jenny showed her the numbers in spring 2003 spreadsheets that tracked customer acquisition and retention over the past 5 years. Revenue was flat. Costs were rising with inflation and parts prices. In 5 years, maybe less expenses would exceed income. Mom, we need to think about what comes next. What comes next is, we keep working. The business isn't growing. The market's shrinking. At some point, we need an exit strategy. Ruth looked at the spreadsheets, seeing her life's work reduced to trend lines and projections. The numbers were accurate, she couldn't dispute that. But they missed something essential about why the business existed. This isn't built to sell, it's built to serve. Jenny understood, but understanding didn't change the mathematics. Coleman Equipment Services was sustainable in its current form, but it wasn't positioned for growth or transition. When Ruth could no longer work, when age or health forced her retirement, the business would likely end with her. Marcus could maintain equipment, but he didn't have the customer relationships or the decades of trust that made farmers call Ruth instead of dealerships. Frank's Parkinson's progressed through 2004 and 2005. By 2006, he needed a walker for anything beyond short distances. His medication controlled the tremors partially, but couldn't stop the overall decline. He remained mentally sharp, still handled phone calls, still reviewed contracts. But his physical presence diminished steadily, his world contracting to the house and the short path to the shop. Ruth turned 70 in January 2006. She felt every year of it in her joints, in her back, and the way heavy work left her exhausted for days afterward. But she kept working because stopping felt like surrender, and surrender meant admitting that everyone who'd said she couldn't do this had been right all along. The heart attack came on a Wednesday afternoon in late January. Ruth was in the shop alone, Marcus out on a service call working on the fuel injection system of a 1971 John Deere 432. Oh! She felt pressure building in her chest, a weight that made breathing difficult. At first, she thought it was indigestion, something from lunch sitting wrong. Then the pressure increased and her left arm went numb. Ruth sat down on an overturned bucket because standing suddenly seemed impossible. The shop spun slightly, her vision narrowing at the edges. She sat there for 20 minutes trying to decide if this was serious or if she was overreacting, if calling for help was necessary or embarrassing. Finally, she walked to the house. Frank was napping in his recliner, a common pattern since his afternoon medication made him drowsy. Ruth touched his shoulder, and he woke immediately, seeing her face and understanding before she spoke. Frank called 911. The paramedics arrived in 14 minutes, loaded Ruth into the ambulance while she protested that she could drive herself. Frank rode along his walker folded in the back, his face showing the kind of fear that came from watching your partner of 42 years struggle for breath. The hospital kept her for 11 days. Tests revealed significant arterial blockage damage to heart muscle that meant Ruth's days of heavy physical labor were over. The cardiologist was direct about limitations. No more crawling under machines. No more lifting components heavier than 20 pounds. No more 16-hour workdays during peak season. Ruth listened to these restrictions with growing frustration. Her body had betrayed her the same way Morrison's had betrayed her 20 years earlier, told her she was done when she still had work to finish. "Can I still drive?" The cardiologist nodded. "Then I can still work." Jenny brought Frank to the hospital every day. Marcus visited after finishing service calls, standing awkwardly by the bed, unsure what to say to someone who'd taught him everything he knew about machines, but nothing about illness. Ruth reassured him that the business would continue, that she just needed a few weeks to recover. But recovery meant accepting a new reality. Ruth could diagnose problems, could direct repairs, could manage customer relationships. The physical work, the part she'd always done herself, now belonged to Marcus. The transition took 3 weeks. Marcus was 30 years old, had been working for Ruth for 7 years. He knew every machine in the fleet by its service history, knew every customer by name and acreage and crop rotation. He knew how Ruth thought about maintenance, understood her philosophy of prevention over repair. What he didn't know was whether he could do this without her hands-on involvement. Ruth reassured him by demonstrating she could still be useful without lifting wrenches. She drove to service calls, diagnosed problems from symptoms described over the phone, directed Marcus through complex repairs by telling him what to check and in what order. They developed a new rhythm. Marcus did the physical work. Ruth did the thinking. Together they maintained the same service standards Coleman Equipment Services had always provided. Frank's decline accelerated through 2006 and 2007. He needed full-time care by 2008, his medication no longer adequate to control symptoms. Jenny moved back home permanently that year to help with caregiving, managing his pill schedule and doctor's appointments while still handling the business accounting. Her own life had stabilized after the Dallas crisis. She'd found work doing bookkeeping for several small businesses around Abilene, had built a modest client base that provided steady income and flexible hours. Ruth watched her family reshape itself around Frank's disease and her own limitations, feeling guilt that her husband and daughter had become caregivers when she'd always been the one solving problems. But Frank never complained, and Jenny never suggested this was burden rather than obligation. In fall 2008, Ruth decided to retire the 1963 John Deere 4020 from active rental. The first tractor she'd bought at auction, the machine that had started everything. It had been rented continuously from 1988 through 2008, 20 years of seasonal service across 11 different farms. The customer log showed approximately 14,000 acres of West Texas farmland worked by that single machine. The reason for retirement wasn't mechanical failure. Ruth's maintenance had kept the 4020 running reliably, its engine still strong, its hydraulics still functional. But farmers increasingly wanted enclosed cabs, climate control operator comfort, that an open station 1963 tractor couldn't provide. The demand for vintage equipment was declining as the generation that had grown up with these machines aged out of farming. Ruth could have sold the 4020. The collector market for restored John Deere tractors was strong, and a machine with documented service history and proven reliability would bring good money. But selling it felt wrong, felt like abandoning something that had proven her point. What nobody knew, what Ruth had never told anyone, including Frank, was that the 4020 had a history beyond her ownership. She'd looked up the original owner in county records back in 1987, tracing the serial number through property seizure documents. Margaret Ann Parker, a woman who'd run 480 acres of cotton outside Sweetwater from 1963 to 1984, lost her farm in the agricultural crisis, died of cancer in 1986, 6 months before the government auction. Margaret had been one of the only other female farmers in West Texas during that era. Ruth had discovered this through newspaper archives at the library articles from the 1960s mentioning Margaret's cotton yields and farming innovations. She'd faced the same discrimination Ruth faced as a mechanic, the same skepticism about whether women belonged in agricultural work traditionally dominated by men. Margaret lost everything to economic forces beyond her control, forces that didn't account for people like them. The 4020 was the last piece of her farm to survive seized by the government and left to deteriorate in an impound lot until Ruth bought it for $400. Ruth decided the tractor deserved better than being sold for parts or left to rust as a lawn ornament. It deserved a full restoration, a memorial to Margaret and to every woman who'd worked in agriculture despite a world that questioned their right to be there. Winter. 2008 through early 2009, Ruth and Marcus gave the 4020 a complete restoration. Not a service rebuild, not routine maintenance, but a ground-up remanufacture to original specifications. They pulled the engine, completely rebuilt it with new pistons and bearings, machined the cylinder sleeves back to factory tolerances. Every hydraulic seal and line got replaced. Every electrical connection got cleaned and properly insulated. Ruth mixed the paint herself, matching the specific shade of John Deere green used in early 1960s production. Not the brighter green of later years, but the slightly yellower tone that characterized machines from Margaret's era. She supervised while Marcus applied it, making sure the coverage was even and authentic. They finished in late February 2009. The 4020 sat in the shop, looking like it had just rolled off the Waterloo factory floor 56 years earlier. Ruth insisted on starting it herself, climbing into the open station seat, despite her cardiologist's restrictions about physical exertion. The engine fired on the fourth crank, settling into the steady rhythm of properly timed diesel combustion. Ruth let it idle, listening to machinery that had been dead for 3 years in 1987, had worked for 20 years under her care, and now represented something larger than agricultural equipment. It represented persistence. It represented women who refused to accept limitations others tried to impose. Ruth drove the 4020 out of the building and across the property, testing everything one final time. Then she drove it back into the original 1,200-square-foot shop and parked it in the corner. Marcus helped her cover it with a canvas tarp. Underneath that tarp, the 4020 would wait preserved but not abandoned, a reminder that some things were worth more than their market value. The recognition Ruth had avoided for most of her career found her anyway in spring 2010. Dr. Patricia Holloway, who'd published the Agricultural Economics paper in 1998, nominated Ruth for the Rural Innovation Award at the Texas Agricultural Conference. The committee voted unanimously to honor her work, sent an invitation to speak at the conference in Dallas in April. Ruth's initial response was refusal. She didn't do public speaking, didn't see herself as someone worthy of awards or recognition. She fixed tractors. That was the job. But Jenny and Frank both pushed back, Frank especially insistent despite his declining health, "Ruth, let them see you." The weight behind those words carried more than encouragement. Frank knew his time was limited, knew his wife deserved recognition she'd spent decades avoiding. This might be his last chance to watch the world acknowledge what he'd always known, that Ruth Coleman had built something extraordinary from 14 broken tractors and stubborn determination. Ruth stood at a podium in front of 300 people on April 18, 2010. Agricultural Economists Extension agents, USDA officials, farmers. She was 73 years old, wearing clothes Jenny had picked out because Ruth's usual work attire didn't seem appropriate for a conference hall. The speech lasted 11 minutes. Ruth told the story of buying tractors nobody wanted, of spending 4 months rebuilding a machine everyone said was worthless, of answering phone calls at 2 in the morning because that's what the work required. She talked about Margaret Parker for the first time publicly, about the woman who'd lost her farm and died before seeing the crisis end. This business wasn't about tractors. It was about trust, about showing up when you say you'll show up, about understanding that people need partners, not vendors. She talked about Jenny's spreadsheets showing the market shrinking, about Marcus taking over the physical work, about aging and limitation, and the reality that nothing lasts forever. But while it lasted, we proved something. We proved that reliability matters more than modernity, that service matters more than scale, that one person who answers the phone matters more than a corporation with better equipment. The audience gave her a standing ovation. Ruth stood at the podium feeling uncomfortable with the attention, but also feeling something else. Validation, maybe. Proof that 23 years of work had mattered beyond her customer base, had demonstrated principles that extended past equipment rental into how people treated each other in business. But what Ruth didn't say, what she couldn't say in front of 300 people, was that she'd spent those 23 years proving that a woman could do something everyone said was impossible. And she'd done it not to prove them wrong, but because the work mattered, because farmers needed someone who answered the phone, because giving up meant accepting that Morrison's had been right to fire her, that the world had been right to question whether she belonged. The years between 2010 and 2014 brought steady contraction. Ruth continued working, but at reduced capacity, her role shifting more toward customer relationships and diagnostic consultation. Marcus ran daily operations, handled all physical maintenance, managed the fleet that had stabilized at 44 machines. Jenny took over all administrative functions, managed the books, coordinated rentals, dealt with suppliers. Coleman Equipment Services remained profitable, serving 28 farming operations with reliable equipment and responsive service. The business had found its sustainable size, the level where revenue covered expenses with modest profit margin. It wasn't growing, but it wasn't failing either. Frank died on November 12, 2012. Pneumonia complicated by Parkinson's, his body finally unable to fight infections his medication couldn't prevent. He died at home with Ruth and Jenny beside him. The funeral drew 150 people, testament to a man who'd spent 40 years selling insurance and building relationships across the community. Ruth knelt by the casket before they closed it, whispered something nobody else heard. Later, when Jenny asked what she'd said, Ruth just smiled. "I told him we did good, didn't we?" Ruth's final year was quieter than the ones before. She still went to the shop most days, still consulted on difficult rebuilds, still took calls from longtime customers who trusted her judgment. But she spent more time sitting than working, more time watching Marcus than directing him. She started a project nobody knew about, working on it in the evenings after Marcus went home. A manual handwritten in the same careful script she'd used for service records. 237 pages documenting every technique she'd learned in 50-plus years of mechanical work. Not just procedures, but philosophy, the approach to listening that separated good mechanics from exceptional ones. She titled it, "What Machines Tell You If You Listen." The last entry was dated March 2014, 1 month before her death. The machines don't care if you're male or female, young or old, educated or not. They only care if you listen. And if you listen long enough, they'll teach you everything you need to know about engines and about life. Ruth Coleman died on April 9, 2014. Congestive heart failure, the same cardiac issues that had started in 2006, finally overwhelming her system. She was 77 years old. Jenny was with her at the end. Marcus was at the shop servicing a tractor when Jenny called. He finished the job before leaving for the hospital because Ruth would have wanted it done. The farmer needed the machine the next morning. The funeral drew over 200 people, an unusual number for someone who'd never advertised, never sought publicity beyond Dr. Holloway's academic paper and the agricultural conference speech. Most of the 200 were farmers, or children of farmers, or widows of farmers. People whose operations had depended on Ruth's reliability, whose livelihoods had been protected by someone who answered the phone at 2 a.m. Dot Pittman sat in the third row, 81 years old, no longer farming but still sharp and present. She'd rented Ruth's machines for 23 consecutive years from 1987 until 2010, when she finally sold her land and retired. When someone asked what she remembered most about Ruth, her answer was immediate. She answered the phone. At 2 a.m. during planting season, she answered the phone, and she never once made you feel like you were bothering her. Gerald Fuchs stood at the reception afterward talking quietly with Carl Henderson. Both men had rented from Ruth for over 20 years, had built their farming operations on the foundation of reliable equipment and responsive service she'd provided. Never met anyone who kept a promise like Ruth. Carl nodded. She didn't just fix my tractors. She kept my farm alive when nobody else would. Marcus stood apart from the groups, uncomfortable with crowds but unwilling to leave. Several people approached him, farmers who knew he'd taken over daily operations, asking what would happen to Coleman Equipment Services. Marcus gave the same answer to everyone. We keep going. That's what Ruth would want. Coleman Equipment Services still operates today out of the same two metal buildings on the same property outside Abilene. Marcus Webb runs it 51 years old now, his hair graying but his mechanical knowledge as sharp as when Ruth first trained him. He hired his own mechanic 3 years ago, a young woman named Sarah Mitchell from the Sweetwater Votech program. Sarah reminds him, he says of himself at 22, the fleet has 44 machines. Most are newer than Ruth's original acquisitions tractors from the 1980s and 1990s, bought at auction and rebuilt in the shop. They're rented to the same kinds of farming operations Ruth served, mid-tier operations that need reliable equipment without the financial burden of ownership. Marcus kept the filing system Ruth created. He added a computer, a used desktop he bought in 2015 that runs spreadsheet software alongside the handwritten service records. But the handwritten records remain every machine carrying a paper history dating back to the day it arrived. The filing cabinet from Ruth's kitchen now sits in the office corner, its drawers still organized in her system. The 1963 John Deere. 4020 remains in the corner of the original 1,200-square-foot shop under its canvas tarp. Marcus starts it once a year, on the anniversary of the March 1987 auction where Ruth bought it. The ritual happens every spring, a private memorial to the woman who proved that broken things could be rebuilt and that people who'd been counted out could still create value. The tractor starts on the third or fourth crank every time its engine maintained, even in retirement. Marcus lets it idle for 20 minutes, listening to diesel combustion that sounds exactly like Ruth described it should sound. Machinery doing exactly what machinery is supposed to do. He doesn't drive it anywhere. He just sits in the seat and listens, understanding that some sounds matter beyond their mechanical function. Marcus found Ruth's manual after her funeral, the handwritten pages she'd created during her final year. 237 pages of techniques and philosophy knowledge accumulated over 5 decades and transcribed in careful script. He keeps it in the shop, refers to it when facing difficult rebuilds, treats it like the sacred text it is. The last page. Ruth's final entry sits bookmarked. Marcus has read it hundreds of times, but the words still carry weight. The machines don't care if you're male or female, young or old, educated or not. They only care if you listen. And if you listen long enough, they'll teach you everything you need to know about engines and about life. Jenny is co-owner now, handles all business administration, while Marcus manages operations. She married in 2015, has 2 children who sometimes visit the shop and watch their uncle Marcus work. Jenny tells them stories about their grandmother, about the woman who bought 14 broken tractors and built a business the world said couldn't exist. People ask if Ruth proved something by succeeding as a female mechanic who built a profitable business from nothing. But that's not how Ruth saw it. She just saw work that needed doing, and she did it. The fact that she was a woman who did it just meant the work was harder. But the work mattered the same amount regardless of who was doing it. Before you go, I want to ask you something. Have you ever been underestimated because of who you are, or watched someone you love fight to prove themselves in a world that didn't think they belonged? Ruth Coleman's story isn't just about tractors. It's about what happens when we refuse to accept other people's limitations. Drop a comment below. I read every single one. It is not a complicated legacy. But legacies rarely are when they're real.